Off the Ball, GAA.
No motivation. We've a crowd of fellas down there that are training since last November, and obviously we addressed it at the start about the All-Ireland final last year, and that back of the head straight away then after that.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah,
I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters, thank you for the team, thank you France. Merci la France, merci les baguettes, merci les croissants. Je vous aime, I love you.
I am delighted to be joined by Professor Kirsty Elliott-Sale, who is a researcher and global leader who specialises in female endocrinology and exercise physiology, a professor in Manchester Metropolitan University, where she is also the head and the centre of excellence for women in sport. Beyond academia, she has collaborated with leading organisations such as the United Kingdom Sports Institute, UEFA and Arsenal Women's Football Team, to name but a few. That was a short introduction. I could have gone for a lot longer. Kirsty, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks a million for that lovely introduction. It was the perfect length. In fact, you could have even made it shorter. But no, that's really lovely. Thanks for the kind words.
Kirsty, I suppose I heard you speak at a MEDA research event in Ireland a couple of weeks ago, and just everything you spoke about was so fascinating. And I suppose we'll just start off by asking you about the research that you're doing there at the moment.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was a great conference, wasn't it? And always nice to be invited back home to give a talk. In fact, sometimes it freaks people out when they hear the Irish accent, because based on your introduction, obviously I live and work in England, so the accent sometimes catches them off. I guess what I spoke about at the conference was sort of the work that we've been doing here for the last 4 years, but actually the work sort of, I guess, extends my whole career, because I started working in this area in, 1998, and I was just looking there at your memorabilia behind you of Italia 90 and makes me feel very old. So yeah, I started researching in female athletes in 98, and have worked exclusively my whole career with sort of girls and women's sport. And my whole career, it's been a real sort of common theme. You know, I've been really interested in female specific considerations, and, you know, I guess more specifically how the ovarian hormone estrogen and progesterone might affect performance. Now, that probably sounds very sciencey to the listeners, so let me put it in another way. I started off being really fascinated by the menstrual cycle, so that's what I mean by changes in ovarian hormones. And actually, over my career, I've been really fortunate that that's extended out into things like hormonal contraception, pregnancy, so a real change in space with pregnancy, particularly in women's football. And now, even extending into menopause. So really anything that the listeners can think of to do with the ovaries, that's the type of research I do within the context of girls and women's sport.
One of the things you spoke about at the conference was the idea that sportswomen are a new phenomenon, and that they were only invented after the Paris Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, saying there that I'm old and I've been around a long time, certainly I wasn't doing podcasts 20 years ago because nobody was talking about this area. And I would say very much the first 10, maybe even towards 15 years of my career, I was very much a researcher based in a lab, based in a university. And I think for me, certainly in the UK, it was the run-up to the Tokyo Olympics that really sort of changed things. And that's when organisations like the United Kingdom Sports Institute sort of started to reach out and say, well, look, the idea behind Tokyo is to get parity in participation. So as many sports women going as there are sports men to the games. And so we started to work together. I mean, parity wasn't achieved at those games in Tokyo, but as you say, there in Paris in the last games, that was when parity was reached. So I'd say the last 5 to 7 years, it's almost, I always describe it like the lights came on. you know, we were sort of researching, working in the dark, and the lights came on. And so there's a real sort of, as you say, appetite now. Everybody's talking about this area. And, you know, it's a real sort of, I guess, tongue-in-cheek joke, but it would appear from the outside looking in that, you know, female athletes were suddenly, you know, discovered just a few years ago, despite the fact that, we've been here since the dawn of time and we clearly represent half of the world's population. So, yeah, so, you know, I think an important point to make before I finish this sort of particular point is that just because we weren't talking about it, up until lately, doesn't mean that there wasn't research being conducted. So I always like to give that sort of little shout out to the researchers who have been working in this field 20, 30, 40 years. And certainly when I started 25 years ago, some great researchers out there who I was able to, as the saying goes, stand on the shoulders of giants. So I think the best way to describe it is there has been some research going on for, you know, 20, 30 years, but it's been a relatively small amount, and obviously we want it to be much bigger, so a higher quantity of research, but also we have had some sort of, I guess, issues with the quality of that research. And I'll give you a really easy and quick example of that. If we think, and we probably all agree, that women's sport isn't funded very well, then that has the knock-on effect that then, of course, the research into women's sport is not funded well. And so if you don't have a lot of funding to do the studies in sports science and sports science and medicine or nutrition or injury, any of those aspects, if you don't have a lot of money, it really hinders your ability to do high-quality research. So, yeah, there's been a real evolution. And suddenly, as we say, in the last few years, a lot of people are going, oh, female athletes. That's a new hot topic. So yeah, very tongue-in-cheek, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Like you said, you've been there and people have done it before you. I wonder, Kirsty, is it when you've got people who maybe don't have the funding and they're conducting research, and then all of a sudden a line from a study comes out and people might latch onto it and say, this is the case, but when you actually delve into the data, it was a very small sample size. Is that almost more dangerous than no research at all sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really clever sort of question and a really clever way to look at it. It seems almost counterintuitive, doesn't it, to say, you know, look, if it's going to be low quality research, don't do it. Because, you know, most people are saying do more research, and even the athletes themselves are calling for more research. But you're absolutely right. Some, you know, low quality research can be quite dangerous if it's sort of like overstated, you know, if it's maybe taken out of context. And so what we really want is, you know, research that's of a high quality, but we also want to see sort of studies replicated by different, I'm going to say, independent research groups. So that means if I do a study in my lab in Manchester, and you know, these are my findings, it would be really great if somebody, say, in a lab in Dublin or Athlone, they did the same study and they showed the same findings. And then if another independent group somewhere else in the world, maybe in Australia, did the same study and then the same findings, because that means that, you know, we're actually in agreement. It's not a one off. It's not an accident. It's not an artifact. And, you know, that sort of independent replication really gives us that sort of confidence. So I guess it's a combination of, you know, quality and quantity. And, you know, just getting a substantial body of evidence that, you know, is high quality, we have confidence in it, and then we start making those changes. But yeah, as you say, it's really dangerous. You know, whenever I go in to work with a new sport and I see some maybe practices that I think, oh, you know, why are you doing that? Or, you know, that's not evidence-based. That's not really what the science is telling us. And you get somebody who says, I read a study that said that. And, you know, that's my heart sinks, because then you're sort of trying to explain, look, if it's just one study, you know, that might have been on, you know, even if it's on 10 women, like 10 women don't represent the whole world. And, you know, especially if those 10 women were, you know, they weren't elite athletes, and then this sort of person is trying to put that into the elite space, because it's not quite the same. I think you'd agree that if I go out for a run at nearly age 50, a little 5K, it's not really equivalent to somebody running in the, you know, in the Olympic Games at the, you know, 100 meter sprint final. So I think it's things like looking at, you know, what is the sample size, which population, you know, was it done in, has a high quality approach been taken? And you know, maybe that's something we'll come back to, because, you know, determining what's high quality can be difficult for, you know, for readers of research. And then if it's been sort of replicated elsewhere, are we seeing this time and time again? And I guess if we've got all of that, that substantial body of high quality research that the scientific community is in agreement, that's when we can start to make sort of big changes in practice. But it can be difficult. It's difficult for the researchers knowing, you know, how to conduct the research. And as I say, it's very difficult for people, you know, on the ground, in the field, wherever you want to put it, on the pitch, to take that information and to use it. And let's be honest, you know, people listening to this, I speak like a scientist. It's a little awkward, it's a little clunky. You know, we always have lots of caveats. You know, we're always saying it could be this, it could be that. And it makes it really, really difficult. And, you know, if you compare that to maybe something like going on social media, you know, the people who are putting content on social media, you know, I guess influencers, their content is usually beautifully presented. It's engaging. You know, it's bite-sized. They speak really nicely, really like salespeople. And you can see why athletes and practitioners then, you know, they sort of lean into that sort of, you know, influencer science, you know, that, well, I don't even want to call it influencer science. Sometimes there's no science at all. But they engage with that sort of content. Whereas if obviously they rock up and sit with me for an hour, they get a lot of, you know, sort of science. It's a bit heavy. It's not always that interesting. And they just want a punchy headline, when in fact it can be hard to give that punchy headline.
For your research at the moment, especially in that social media space, what do you think are the most common myths that are being perpetuated out there? I know you've done a lot of work, might chat to you first, on the cycle tracking apps. I mean, I'm saying that as I look down at my Fitbit here, and it's a great way in one sense that we've come so far and people are conscious of it. And I mean, a lot of people could name the different four phases in the menstrual cycle now, for example, but it's not complete science, these tracking apps, sure it's not.
No, it's not at all. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, going back to that sort of, I guess, analogy I used earlier, you know, up until recently, menstrual cycles, periods, all that sort of stuff wasn't talked about. We were very much in the dark. And, you know, the conversation had to start. And, you know, I think in that sense, the apps certainly started that conversation, sort of got it into, as you say, on everybody's phone, into their watches, Fitbits, all of those sort of things. And, you know, it certainly, you know, started a conversation. I guess for me, that's probably where the compliments end, you know. So you're absolutely right. One of the things that I see on social media is definitely sort of, you know, it sort of starts with the apps and then it grows. So I'll try and give you an example. I get a little ranty. I get a little bit angry when I start to talk about this. So feel free to mute me.
Never. I love the rants, and you're the professional here.
So here's, I guess, the biggest problems. And as I say, it sort of starts with apps, but then it's sort of grown away from those as well. So the first problem is that if you use one of these tracking apps, you, the female athlete, the woman, whoever is using it, you give it a piece of information. So you give that app, the information is when you get your period. And so from the day one that you get your period until the next day that you get it, that's your cycle length. Now, I would argue that you could just stick an X on a calendar, and when you get your period, and you can stick an X on the calendar the next day you get your period, and you just count the days in between. I mean, you know, I know we do maths at school and we all hate it and we try and leave it behind, but let's be honest here, that's not difficult maths, that's just counting days, and that gives you your cycle length. And that's really all the apps can do. So if you want to sort of, you know, get that done in an automated way, that's where it is. But here's where it starts going wrong. Your menstrual cycle isn't just about having a regular period. There are two other things that occur in the menstrual cycle which are really important to us, not just for our reproductive sort of function and health, but also for our wider health. So the first one is ovulation. We really want to obviously ovulate, we release an egg. And of course, if you're thinking about reproduction and fertility, that's really super, obviously super important for getting pregnant. Away from pregnancy, if you want to think about ovulation and general health, the time around ovulation, you get a peak in estrogen. This hormone is also good for other sort of functions away from reproduction. So for example, it's really good for bone health. So obviously we want to ovulate because we want this peak in estrogen. So that's the second thing that's really important in the menstrual cycle. And then the third thing is we want to have a peak in progesterone. So we talk about progesterone sufficiency. So having that peak, having enough progesterone. Now again, progesterone is important to fertility because it builds up the lining of your womb. And again, that's really important if you want to get pregnant. That's where the egg implants, the fertilized egg. But again, it has other functions away from reproduction. So progesterone is used in other sort of physiological systems. So really actually estrogen and progesterone are good for bone health, cardiovascular health, cognitive function. So lots of other things. So all in, as a female athlete, we want to know that we menstruate regularly, so we get our periods regularly, that we ovulate, and that we have sufficient progesterone. And the apps can't do that. The apps can't know if you're ovulating, and the app can't know if you've got sufficient progesterone. And so we have to make other measurements to do that. Now, I do know that some apps, that if you do these measurements, again, you can put that information in. But I would say, why do you need the app? You've already done the measurements. You know what it is yourself. So I think that's one of the biggest problems around the app. You could have a problem with ovulation. You could have a problem with progesterone. But your app's going to tell you that you're healthy. You know, based on that regular bleeding, it's going to assume that you're ovulating. It's going to assume that you've got enough progesterone. And it's going to give you back. It's going to talk back to you and say, you know, hey, Rachel, you're in this phase and, you know, everything's great, and it has no way of knowing. So clearly there's a big problem with health. Now, there's one other thing that I want to sort of, I guess, add to this, and it sort of starts with the apps, but it has certainly grown also on social media. So the second thing is that some of these apps also talk back to the athlete in so much as it starts to give them training advice or nutrition advice based on which phase they're in. Now, I can really clearly tell you there's no research evidence out there. Well, sorry, let me correct that, because of course somebody's sitting listening to this going, I read a paper, there is research evidence. So let me correct that. This is a super important correction. There is not sufficient high quality evidence out there to say that there's a phase where you need to train in a particular way, or a phase in which you need to train a different way. And so if there's no research evidence, there's no credible research evidence saying that we have to do phase-based training, then again, these apps can be very misleading. The same is for nutrition. So if these apps start saying, oh, you should eat this in this phase and you should eat this in a different phase, the research evidence doesn't tell you to do that. So really, if you're a female athlete or you work with female athletes and you're listening to this, the real take-home message is continue to train for the demands of your sport. Okay, menstrual cycle phase-based training is going to lead you down some very sort of dark avenues, some rabbit holes with no, as I say, credible research evidence behind them. It's going to be very distracting. It's logistically really almost impossible, especially again if you're using the app to tell you what phase you're in to dictate your training. Remember, I just said your app doesn't know what phase you're in, it's guessing. So if you're getting this guess, this assumption that you're in a particular phase, and then it's telling you to train a particular way and the research evidence doesn't support it, that sort of means, as I say, you're going off down these rabbit holes you don't need to. I would say the same is true for nutrition. The same is true for injuries. There isn't a phase where you're more or less likely to get injured. Now, here's where people start to get cross at me, because people start to say things like, well, in a such and such a phase, I have maybe some physical symptoms. I have a backache or stomach cramps. Surely I could change my training to accommodate those. And so, yes, absolutely. You can do that. But there's a but here. The but is, if you have these physical symptoms or even emotional symptoms, there's a phase where maybe you feel anxious or distracted, or, you know, you lack self-confidence. Yep, all sort of linked to your menstrual cycle. But if you have these things, rather than continually adapt your training, because let's be honest, we're not talking about adapt our training. We're talking about changing it to make it less. Okay, so if you've got a stomach ache, you want to do less because you don't feel great. Now, especially at the elite end of sport, we want to be training, you know, to prepare for our competition, to prepare for the next event. So you don't want to be losing a lot of days, you know, from optimal training to suboptimal training. So my response would be, absolutely, you can change your training if you want to accommodate symptoms. But please remember, that's an indirect effect of the menstrual cycle. It's not a direct effect. There's no phase where your muscles stop working or your bones are weaker or anything like that. So physiologically, there's no reason to change your training. If indirectly you have these symptoms and you want to change your training, do it. But I would say, why not get rid of those sort of side effects, those symptoms. And especially as they're cyclical, so we know when they're going to happen. So if you know that every time, you know, the 2 or 3 days just before you get your period, you have backache, instead of losing 2 or 3 days or changing your training, changing your training or adapting your training to make it less, why not find an intervention that would get rid of that backache? And that means then you could go back to optimizing your training. So I realized that was a very long answer, so I'm going to try and summarize it if I can. The apps can mislead in terms of health. They don't know if you ovulate and they don't know if you have sufficient progesterone. The apps can mislead if they then take those guessed phases, you know, they've guessed them, they've assumed them, and then start to give you training or nutrition advice. That training or nutrition advice is not based on a significant body of quality evidence. Yes, you can adapt your training. Of course you can if you have symptoms, side effects, that makes sense. But please be aware, it's not menstrual cycle adaptations or menstrual cycle phase-based training. It's actually the system or the process is actually called autoregulation. It's been around since the 1940s. So, and men do it too. So any physical or emotional symptom that you have, which may limit your ability to train or compete, you make an adaptation. So you can, if you want to, you can use autoregulation. That's not phase-based training. And then lastly, I would say, instead of using autoregulation all the time, if you want to optimize your training and performance, why not look for, you know, good interventions that would mitigate either those physical or emotional symptoms. So sorry, such a long answer and hopefully not too ranty, but I've tried to summarize it into those main points.
Not at all. I could have let you go on for another half an hour there, Kirsty. And just on the apps not getting the phases right, is it just something like a urine test and a blood test? Are they the only reasons, the ways we can determine what phase you're in?
Yeah, so that's the thing. And sort of, I always make a, I don't know if it's a good joke or a bad joke, we'll see in a minute. But I always say that, you know, the way that we sort of look at ovulation is again, a sort of an indirect test, but it is a measurement rather than an assumption or a guess. And the way in which we do that is we collect a urine sample and then we put a test strip into it. And obviously it can read that sort of, it's a different hormone, luteinizing hormone. It can read the concentration. And if it's above a certain concentration, then it says, yep, that's the LH surge, and that LH surge is associated with ovulation. So I always joke that unless your phone, and let's be honest, we all do it, we put our phones in our back pockets. So I always make the joke that, you know, unless your phone is dropping into the toilet, happens to have a test strip embedded in it, is able to read your LH, it has no way of knowing that you've ovulated. It doesn't. Like, I can't tell by looking at you today whether or not you're ovulating. So why do we think our phone can? And, you know, I am, like, as I say, it's a long time since I did maths in school. And so I'm no mathematician, I'm no statistician. But, you know, people say things like, oh, but isn't there an algorithm? But what algorithm? You know, the way of knowing whether or not you ovulate is by making a measurement. And unless your phone can make that measurement, how would it know?
Even when we're talking here as well, it's a lot of elite athletes who might have access to, like, a very small number of athletes who might have access to those things. But the misinformation in terms of, especially what you're talking about, the cycle syncing and people laying off exercise on certain days of the cycle. You spoke at the conference about an article that was released in 2023 about the dropsies and how that can feed into to public consciousness and the negative effects that can have on people. And you've had parents approaching you looking to put their children on the contraceptive pill to combat these effects. And in one way, it's nice to see that people are out there looking for research and they're trying to put everything in to get that 1% back for their children. But it's a really dangerous space.
Yeah, it's terrifying. You know, that dropsies that you're talking about, just for the listeners who maybe haven't heard of it. Yeah, it was an article in 2023 where there was an observation made in, I think, one football club around their goalkeepers in two phases of the menstrual cycle. So again, let's do some quick maths. If we say that the average menstrual cycle is a month long, 4 weeks long, for two phases, that could be up to 2 weeks. So for, I guess the headline is sort of around the fact that these goalkeepers for half a cycle, two weeks out of every four, had problems with sort of, I guess, catching, keeping hold of the ball. And they referred to this as the dropsies. And, you know, I'm insulted for all girls and women around the world, because that's not a science word, clearly. That's some sort of, I guess, childish word, like whoopsie, dropsy. And it felt really distasteful that this word was associated with, you know, elite female athletes. And so this phenomenon is not true. It's not universal. You know, certainly somebody could have observed this with their goalkeepers, but it's certainly not you know, linked with the menstrual cycle, and it's certainly not something that all goalkeepers, all women need to worry about. And just, I guess, without going too deep into the science, the two phases that they named, phase one and phase four, interestingly, they have opposing profiles. So what I mean by that is, in phase one, estrogen and progesterone are low, and in phase four, estrogen and progesterone are high. So really, it's physiologically or biologically implausible. Like, if this thing happens when they're low, what do you mean it happens when they're high? So, like, there was just so many flaws in this article. But you're absolutely right. You know, we had goalkeepers from, you know, top flight women's football clubs, or indeed national women's football teams, getting in touch with us saying, like, is this true? Will this happen to our goalkeepers? You know, right the way through to sort of young girls, you know, not even just at like academies, football academies, but just like playing with local teams, thinking, is this true? What should I do about that? And as you rightly said, you know, a lot of people taking that, you know, next giant leap and saying, well, if the menstrual cycle, if two phases, if 2 weeks are lost to this phenomenon, then we should get rid of the menstrual cycle. And as you said, the really obvious and easy way to get rid of the menstrual cycle is to replace it with a different profile, and that different profile being the oral contraceptive pill. So just to be super clear to the listeners, the dropsies are not real. And so you don't have to run out and get a new hormonal profile to avoid it. You're going to be absolutely fine catching and holding the ball. There may be many reasons you don't catch or hold the ball, but right now we're not saying that that's linked to the phase of the menstrual cycle. So yeah, we can clear that one up. But I think really scary headlines, you know, very misleading. And, you know, you're absolutely right that when these headlines come out, and they get into every corner, every space, you know, that came out in 2023. In 2026, we're still talking about it. I still have people coming up and asking me about it. And sort of, I've started to describe it as a zombie idea. It just won't die and go away. And so I wish it would die and go away and we could stop talking about it. But it's super important that, you know, we really do bust that myth. And hopefully one day we'll not be talking about the dreaded dropsies.
And ACLs as well, on the dreaded myths, is something we hear a lot about. And we don't want to come to a point where players are afraid to train and afraid to play while they're on their period for fear of doing an ACL. Is there science behind any link towards that?
No, so I'm really glad you brought this one up, because again, I see that, like, there's a real potential there for that to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if you're scared, it's going to affect the way that you play and make decisions. And then, you know, if you're making poor decisions, and if you're tentative and distracted, then you might absolutely end up with a non-contact ACL injury. So yeah, I guess a couple of ways I can put this. The first is that the research evidence, so studies that have been done in this area, again, we could talk about, is there enough of them? What's the quality? But let me just tell you what the research evidence, good or bad, what it's saying. So it actually would point towards a link between the ovulatory phase, when estrogen is high, and these injuries. So just in case the listeners are unclear, I have not just said ACL injuries are linked to the ovulation phase. I'm saying there's some research evidence. What's coming out of laboratories is saying that. I don't actually believe that. But I just wanted to raise that, because what is very interesting is the players themselves and the media, they are talking about these ACL injuries occurring during menstruation when estrogen is low. So instantly you can see, again, there's this tension. Some of the science is saying estrogen is high, increased risk, and actually the athletes themselves and the sort of media are saying when estrogen is low, these injuries are occurring. Now this, I think, is the super important thing that I hope everybody hears. Neither is true. There is not enough, and I'm going to keep saying this, there is not enough high quality evidence to say either of those things are true, so one or the other. And in fact, I'm going to name the club here because they won't mind at all me doing so. You mentioned in the introduction that I work with Arsenal women's football team. It's an absolute pleasure to work with the guys there. And a few seasons ago, there were 4 ACL injuries in one season, and the club really invested a lot of time, money, effort into looking into, you know, what similarities those 4 players had. And what I can tell you is one thing they did not have in common is the phase of the menstrual cycle in which that injury occurred. So they all had the same injury, not all was in the same phase. Now again, I'm not saying this is a scientific fact, but it's a sample size of 4 women. But what I'm saying is that, you know, if we want to take real life examples, we have this one club with 4 players all having the same injury in the same season, and menstrual cycle phase was not the thing they had in common. And so, again, it's just really important to make sure that everybody's listening, I guess, to the conclusion of our ACL, which phase would you get an ACL injury in? We don't know. There are many, many reasons why you could sustain a non-contact ACL injury. But right now, either anecdotally or from the research evidence, I feel very confident in saying I don't think your non-contact ACL injury is caused by your estrogen concentration, whether that's a low concentration or high concentration. I think we've got many more things to look at, whether it's what pitch they're on, what boots they wear, you know, the fact that there's a whole what we call gendered environment between women's football and men's football. You know, we've got to overcome all those disparities first. You know, we're not comparing like for like. When everybody says, oh, women get way more ACL injuries than men, it's like, well, we don't have a boy and a girl at the same age that start football on the same day, that have exactly the same opportunities, funding, resources, staff, boots, etc. They have each a 20-year career, and then we compare their incidence of ACL injuries. So we're not comparing like for like. It's entirely different, sort of the evolution of women's football compared to men's football. So yeah, all in, sorry, I went off on a tangent, but all in, let me bring it back. Non-contact ACL injuries, very, very unlikely to be caused by estrogen concentration. And therefore, there is not a phase of the menstrual cycle where you're more or less likely to get an ACL injury. So please do go out there and play the way you want to. Please do not be scared of these injuries occurring when you've got your period.
For someone who's listening to this now, Kirsty, and they're trying to, like you mentioned before, auto-regulate, they're trying to get more just in tune with their body and the different ways it works. But they're also being fed a lot of these, like you spoke about before, digestible, really beautiful pieces of content on Instagram and TikTok. Would you have advice for someone who's out there looking for practical, data-driven science on how best to work around their menstrual cycle when they're exercising?
Yeah, that's an important but a tough question to answer. What I really need is a credible scientist to, you know, I mean, if you're a credible scientist, you're busy enough, but if we could just find somebody who could also make beautiful bite-sized content and flood social media with that'd be fantastic. But in the absence of that, what really can female athletes do for themselves? Well, I mean, I would say the first thing is to upskill, you know, get some education in this topic. And, you know, that can be easier said than done. Like, I mean, some sports, some organizations, some countries, I guess it depends on a lot of factors, but sometimes they will bring in, hopefully, experts to talk about menstrual cycles, do some education. And I guess if you have that opportunity, what I'm saying is, please don't, you know, look at that person and go, they're boring, they're old, they've got a PowerPoint, I'm not going to listen. You know, if they're there for 45 minutes an hour, do sit up, do lean in, do listen hard and get that information, because, you know, it's a cliche, it's a stereotype, but it's true. Knowledge is power. So if you genuinely know, and as I say, it always relies on that access to credible information or a credible expert. But if you do get that opportunity to, whether it's a PowerPoint or somebody comes in and has a chat to you, or you're listening to a podcast, try and learn about your body, you know, learn what the menstrual cycle is, you know, learn the different ways it can affect you. And I think we've covered most of the ways, but if I can, Rachel, I'm just going to take 30 seconds to just sort of remind how the menstrual cycle could affect you. So one, it could affect you through symptoms. That's an indirect effect. And again, as you said nicely, we can use auto-regulation to change, to anticipate when those things are happening and to change our training, or we can use their cyclicity, the fact that they happen in a repeatable, predictable pattern, to do interventions to get rid of them. So that's the first way, an indirect effect through symptoms. A second way is perception. If people keep constantly telling you you're going to lose in this phase or you're going to get injured in this phase, perception shapes reality. So again, it's an indirect way in which your menstrual cycle might affect your ability to train or compete. There's another way, which we didn't speak too much about today, or maybe it will come later, but if you have menstrual dysfunction, so if something goes wrong with your menstrual cycle and it's not perfect, you know, you're not ovulating all the time, or you have insufficient progesterone, that's called menstrual dysfunction. And clearly that's a marker of ill health. And as we know, if you want to optimize training and performance, you need to be healthy. So the third way in which your menstrual cycle might affect you is if you have menstrual dysfunction, you're not at optimum health, and that might impede your ability to train or compete. So far, three indirect ways. The last indirect way, and again, we haven't covered this, and I think it's an important point. Part of the menstrual cycle is menstruation. We've mentioned it a lot, having your period. And let's be honest and let's be really blunt about it. You're bleeding. And if we take examples, I don't know whether you want to think about a sport like tennis and Wimbledon, or we take a sport like cricket and you wear cricket whites, or you want to take a football and you might have white shorts on. As a female athlete, if you have your period, if you're bleeding and you're wearing white shorts, and, you know, I don't care whether you're competing at your local football pitch and there's a handful of people watching you versus you're on the TV in centre court at Wimbledon wearing white head to toe, it can cause anxiety and distraction to think, I have my period today. Oh my God, I really hope that doesn't stay in my white clothes and everyone can see it. And some people don't care, or some people, that thought doesn't enter their head. So it's not an effect for everybody. But if you get that thought, or maybe your thought might be, God, my period's due anytime now. And, you know, God, I hope it doesn't happen during the match or during the race. And you know, we've seen those images on social media. So my point here is my fourth indirect point is that physical act of bleeding can also indirectly affect your ability to train or compete by causing you anxiety and distraction. And then that just leaves us with the last way, and I'm a physiologist, so this is what I mean when I say menstrual cycle phase research doesn't say this. So the last way is that biological pathway, the idea that some days we have high estrogen, some days we have low estrogen, some days we have high progesterone, some days we have low progesterone. That those hormones are in our bloodstream. Where are they traveling in the body? Say, for example, if they travel to your muscle, is that concentration of estrogen or progesterone able to improve or actually impede your muscle's ability to produce force? And that's what I say when I say there's insufficient high quality evidence to say menstrual cycle affects your performance. That's what I'm talking about. So right now there doesn't seem to be a phase which the estrogen or progesterone goes to your muscle and makes it better or makes it worse. So all in, to recap, those are five ways in which we think the menstrual cycle might affect. And so finally, I'll go back to your answer. What can the female athletes do? Well, hopefully they can listen to this podcast and get that information. They might have to listen to it several times. There was a lot of information in there, a lot of talking. But if they get this type of knowledge, and if they learn, so education, they know their own bodies, they look for ways of mitigating these sort of indirect negative effects, then I think that's really positive. And if they want to check their menstrual health, then the ovulation kits, you can buy them from pharmacies, you can get them from supermarkets, you can do that. The blood sample might be a little bit more difficult, but again, if you're in a sport and if you get the opportunity that someone says, you want me to check your progesterone, I would say do it. So the answer to my question is education, 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 and, you know, check your ovulation if you want to at home or with your club, sport or organization. And if you do get the chance to check your progesterone, again, you can do that. And of course, you're always able to go to your GP, your own doctor, and ask for help with this. But very long answer, but they're the sort of tangible things you can do. And if I was being if I was being cheeky, I might say delete your social media and stop looking at some of the rubbish that's out there. But yeah, I think that would be mean and a bit cheeky, because there's some good stuff out there too, but it can be hard to find.
Kirsty, I could talk to you about this all day long, but I'd better leave you go to get back to researching this so we can get some more definitive answers and we can get that high quality, well-funded research that we were hoping for. I suppose one of the biggest takeaways I have from this chat today is that the menstrual cycle in terms of training is not something to be feared. It's something that perception is so important that if we just take a positive approach to it and we know that, all right, this isn't going to affect me, you know, just drive on. It's one of the most important things that it should be something that's empowering us and not holding us back when we go to train.
100%. You've really summarized a lot of talking.
Drive on,
into
not very
nice.
Scientific.
No, but it's a really nice point. Like, we need to stop fearing our menstrual cycles. We need to stop worrying about, is this my strong or my weak phase? Is this my winning or my losing phase? Is this my injury phase? We've just got to understand that right now, credible data doesn't say that. And I'm not trying to diminish anybody's experiences. You know, if your menstrual cycle is causing you real anxiety or as I say, these physical symptoms, that's really impactful. But what I would say is, instead of us spending our lives going, God, my menstrual cycle's awful, I get a load of symptoms and I can't train and I can't compete, and Jesus, I hope the Olympic final's not on that day, I would love for us again to have that positivity, change that narrative and say to ourselves, Jesus, I'm going to go out there and find somebody who's going to help me get rid of that symptom, that it means that I can train, it means that I can compete on any day. So yeah, I really agree with you. Let's be positive. Let's not sort of, you know, be influenced by pseudoscience or myths. And you know, where we do face some challenges, and there are challenges with our menstrual cycles, I would say, instead of just going, that's how it is, again, be proactive and say, I wonder what I could do about this. Because let's be honest, everybody listening to this, we just want to train, we want to compete, and we want to be healthy. And so that's what we need to be able to do.
Professor Kirsty Elliott-Sale, thank you so much for joining us today on Word on the Street.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah.
I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters, thank you for the team, thank you France. Merci la France, merci les baguettes, merci les croissants. Je vous aime, I love you.